Vilina Kako. Greetings, everyone. My name is Ke Haolani Kawanui, and I'm your host on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. This program features the political and cultural struggles and resistance of Indigenous peoples. The show is produced in the studios of WESU in Middletown, Connecticut. This location is also known as Mattabesset, the traditional homeland of the Wangunk Indian tribe. On today's show, we have two parts. The first segment will feature Indigenous Australian leader Michael Anderson. I'll interview him about the recent debacle during Australia Day, also known as Invasion Day, that took place on January 26, 2012, when demonstrators confronted Prime Minister Julia Gillard and opposition party leader Tony Abbott in relation to the Aboriginal Tent Embassy. The Aboriginal Tent Embassy, which sits on the lawn directly facing Parliament, was co-established by Anderson in 1972. He will discuss the unresolved sovereignty claim of Indigenous Australians. The second part of the show includes a segment of a recent keynote delivered by Palestinian-American journalist Ali Abu Nima at the University of Pennsylvania 2012 National Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Conference held on February 4th. The event touched on every aspect of the multifarious global effort to heed the BDS call and bring an end to Israel's oppression, segregation, and dispossessions of Palestinians. The acronym for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions is BDS. And as I mentioned, Abu Nima was the keynote for the conference. He is the founder of Electronic Intifada, which is an independent online news publication and educational resource focusing on Palestine, its people, politics, culture, and place in the world. We'll start off the show with Michael Anderson, and I'll bring him on the call momentarily, but first I want to tell you more about him. Anderson, also known by his Indigenous name Giller, is the leader of the Ualiya people living in northwestern New South Wales, and he is also native title claimant to their traditional lands on their behalf. Having another Indigenous affiliation, he is also the elected representative for the Elders Council of the Gumilaroi people. From 1969, Gillar was a leader in the Australian Black Power movement and was appointed by his peers as the first Aboriginal ambassador to White Australia after he and three comrades established what was later called the Aboriginal Tent Embassy on the front lawns of Australia's Parliament House in 1972. In 1979, he was appointed to the Office of the Public Prosecutions in Criminal Law as a solicitor in the state of New South Wales. He is currently engaged in a new political movement in Australia that promotes the continuing sovereignty of Indigenous peoples worldwide. He joins me by telephone from a hilltop on his grandmother's homeland called Lightning Ridge, which he tells me is the only place in the world where black opal is found. Greetings, Michael Anderson. Are you on the line?
I am indeed.
Thank you so much for taking time to join us on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond, all the way from Australia. It's a pleasure and a deep honor to have you on the show.
Well, it's great to connect with you guys. It's wonderful.
Can you start by telling our listeners some about your personal background and also how you came to found the Tent Embassy?
Well, I'm a fellow who grew up in a semi-tribal situation with my grandma and grandpa. And they were in the bush, and I learnt my old ways from them. And as I progressed through the white education system, I was also learning my traditional laws and customary laws as well. And fortunately, I was educated by 80-year-old and 79-year-old men who were the last to be gone through the ancient laws, ceremonies that made them into men, and clever men, or what we call ringan, and it's medicine men in your law. And they taught me all this stuff as I went through high school. And so by the time I finished high school and got into university in Sydney, I finished all of both laws. I went through white universities as well as learning my law in my ancient ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so I walk in both worlds, yeah.
And from 1969, you were a leader in the Australian Black Power movement. And I understand that you were appointed by your peers as the first Aboriginal ambassador to White Australia. Many Americans don't know anything about the Australian Indigenous situation, let alone that there was a Black Power movement. Could you speak to your activist origins related to this movement?
Yeah, I guess my activism came from my mum and others who were talking always now around our table in our camps on because we were fringe-dwelling community when we came in from the bush. And I listen to the old people constantly talking about the racism and what whites used to do to our people all these years and forced us into those situations. And we were less than second-class citizens, and we were kept in that position. But one thing that they kept saying was that one of my great aunties said that, son, you got to learn the white man's ways so that you can lift up his words to see what's underneath them. Found that quite, it was an incredible statement from an old lady who'd never been educated in white law, but knew that that white man's words was meant something, and it had something to do with how they were deceiving us. And so, having now learnt their law and become a lawyer, I'm no longer practicing. But I find it quite interesting, though, that the choice of words, even in the United Nations, when they're talking about human rights and when they're talking rights of people, and even in the legal system itself, the choice of words in legislation as well, they always have two meanings or three meanings, and it depends on the context in which you use it. And this is how they deceive our people. Unless you're clever in the white man's words, then he will deceive you at all times. So learning from the old people about the need to understand that was vital to my education.
Right, to be able to detect deception and also how it's linked to dispossession, yes?
Absolutely.
Now, some coverage came through on mostly leftist media sources and indigenous news media in North America about the recent Australia Day, January 26th, 2012, when there were protests at an event where the reigning Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, was meeting with the opposition leader, Tony Abbott. Could you tell us about that event, and also what is Australia Day and why is it called Invasion Day?
Let's start with Australia Day first. Australia Day came with a group of racists back in the 1930s and 40s who were very authoritarian, fascist type, the neo-Nazi type, settlers in this country who occupied lands around this country. So they were the ultra left wing, or sorry, ultra right wing of Australian society, landowners and wealthy business people. And they founded an organization called the Australian Natives Association, and that Native Association meant people who were born in Australia after the arrival of the British boat people. And we found that when you look at the how it arose, then it's just all about white occupation of Aboriginal lands. Now, from then they called it Australia Day and wanted to celebrate it from that period, and it's always been known as that. But we Aboriginal people call it Invasion Day because that's when they came and settled. And the instructions from the British Admiralty in 1787, one of the instructions on the first page, clause 3, I think it was, that they, when they arrived here, they had to apply the rules and disciplines of war. And to conciliate the affection of Aboriginal people who had already occupied the country was on page 5 of that document. So, yeah, they knew what they were doing, and so as far as we were concerned, it was a military invasion.
So on Invasion Day, January 26th of this year, when Tony Abbott, the neoconservative opposition leader, was really in the same space as the current Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, what was taking place and what were the protests about, and how is it linked to the Tent Embassy?
Well, ironically enough, we've now found that the Governor-General, who is the Queen's representative in Australia, actually organized an award ceremony for, volunteer personnel. And but they put it at a little restaurant about 200 yards away from where our demonstration was, where the Aboriginal Embassy sits, and where we had nearly 1,000 people, over 1,000 people gathered from all over this country. And they were people, young and old, who still had fire in their belly about, dispossession and about the atrocities that have been perpetrated against our people to this day. And so there was a lot of rage, there was a lot of, high blood pressure and heart pounding with anger towards the government and towards the dominant society's rule against us. And then all of a sudden, we got a, whilst the speeches were being made, It was leaked out that the Prime Minister and this Tony Abbott were together in a little restaurant 200 yards away from us, and we thought, well, you know, these people should have shown statesmanship at least and sort of volunteered to come over and address us, knowing the importance of our demonstration and, you know, at least contribute to the discussions, and they would have been all appreciated. But anyway, when the people found out, and the young ones, everybody just circled the building, and, yeah, they were trapped inside of the glass building. And their security, which was pretty dismal, but myself and some other Aboriginal people who were guarding me and my people, we gathered at the door where I knew they would come out.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought at least they would come out in a dignified manner, you know, under the guardianship of their minders, and would at least say hello. And, you know, Tony Abbott would have had an opportunity to say, look, I was misinterpreted, I didn't mean that. Prime Minister Gillard could have, you know, just said hi and hope celebrations are going well and I support you or do whatever you want, you know. But instead of that, the security just opened the door and ran out with their bodyguards and you know, they dropped her in the process. You know, there's films of her being dragged along the ground by her security guards.
Mm-hmm. I did see those.
The security guards panicked. They really panicked, you know, and there was more of us than them anyway. But I can assure you that our elders and, you know, our young men who had spears and boomerangs and waddies, these fellows are painted up in ceremonial regalia, and they're some very big men, let me tell you. There's no way in the world anybody would have got near the Prime Minister and Tony Abbott, or we had everything under control. What happened after the cars left was the police then joined arm and started pushing. And so there are two separate incidents, but they were, you know, spliced for television purposes, you know, to sensationalize the whole thing and dramatize it. But they really missed the point. The point was, though, that and they're still investigating this, actually, mainly media, as to what led to those events. A, who did the risk analysis and failed to identify that there was a risk in having both the Prime Minister and the opposition,
mm-hmm.
two of the leading politicians in this country, sit adjacent to where there was going to be a lot of young, angry and older Aboriginal people who've got a very big grievance against this country. And so who did the risk analysis? And A, why didn't they tell the Australian Federal Police or the Australian Capital Territory Police that they were going to be there? Because when I talked to the sergeant later on about, you know, why didn't you guys tell us that they were going to be there so I could put people there as well and we could make sure that it would be dignified. And he said, look, he looked at me and he shrugged his shoulder and he said, I'm sorry, but we didn't even know either. That was kept under the mat and we weren't know. So the Federal Police and the security people failed to communicate with the Australian Capital Territory Police. And that's why there was not enough policemen there to secure the place, because nobody knew. They just didn't talk to each other. But one thing that comes out of this, and that is that somebody tried to take political capital from this, but it backfired on them.
I see. Now, you mentioned that Tony Abbott could have come out and said that he didn't mean what people thought he said. He made remarks, it's reported, about wanting to disassemble the Aboriginal tent embassy. Could you tell our listeners what the tent or the Aboriginal embassy is in Canberra?
Well, when myself and three other young fellows put that embassy up in 1972, we stuck a beach umbrella, not a flag, because we didn't have a flag of our own at that time. But we stuck a beach umbrella and sat up, and the only reason the beach umbrella was there was because it was raining. And we wrapped ourselves in plastic and some Hessian bag, and we sat under it, and we put a sign up there, Aboriginal Embassy, right in front of the Parliament House. So we were less than 150 metres away from the front door. And we've been there ever since. And there was no law in this country that prevented us from doing that. And I don't think in any democracy there should be a law preventing people from peacefully gathering and voicing their grievances. But we put it up and we said we want land rights because you stole the land from us. You never paid for us. You never negotiated with us for any land. You just, by force, went out there and shot our people and rounded them up and put them into government concentration camps and church mission camps. And these were where you could not move. There's no right of freedom of movement. And you can go through all the Australian laws and you'll see it for yourself. Well, I don't have to tell people. They can read it in black and white if they want to read the laws. But the fact is that we put that embassy up and we said sovereignty never ceded.
Mm-hmm.
We'd never ceded our sovereignty. We'd never treaty with any of the British who came to this country. And so what we've said is that our people have never acquiesced. You never defeated us in war because you never you say you never declared war, and therefore you didn't conquer us. And even if they had declared a war, our laws would have prevailed until they negotiated with us a settlement, a proper peace pact.
Yes.
But that was never done. And, of course, compensation would flow from that as well, reparations and restitution. But none of that occurred. Australia and England keep saying that they did not invade Australia, therefore they couldn't conquer us. But they went with a lie and this fictitious notion that Australia was a desert and uncultivated country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've since gone back and looked at where that originated from, and it came from the papal bulletins in leading back to the 1500s, where they said that, you know, based on the decree between God and Abraham, in Genesis, it said that, you know, the Abraham's children shall become kings and queens of other lands, and they shall take the land of others. And that's based on the premise that we were not Christians, and I think the United Nations Permanent Forum of Indigenous People are looking at this very fact, the doctrine of discovery,
mm-hmm.
at its next meeting in March in New York.
That's right. Now, on Invasion Day, there wasn't even a protest going on at the Aboriginal Embassy, right? This was the celebration of its 40th anniversary?
Absolutely. There was no protest. Everybody gathered. There were flags flying. Other nations were bringing their flags, and we were having flag-raising ceremonies. We had ambassadors there from other parts of the world. We had the Syrian ambassador, and they volunteered to come. And they had a presence there. The Cuban ambassador was there. The Venezuelan ambassador was mm-hmm. there. And the Ecuadorian deputy ambassador was there. So, and met with us. So, you know, this was a formal function recognizing our protest and recognizing the Aboriginal embassy. And
right.
so, all we were saying, we had a march, which about, you know, 1,000, 1,200 people participated in. It was an absolutely wonderful event. Children, it was a safe environment where children was happy, enjoying colours and listening to people talk and watching our people dance, our ceremonial dances. And
mm-hmm.
it was an act of celebration. We had music, modern musicians, and it was a wonderful event.
It's great. I did visit the Aboriginal Embassy in July 2005, and I was really happy to be there. Is the Aboriginal Embassy under threat, and what did Tony Abbott say about that?
Well, he did say that, a lot has passed in the last 40 years, and a lot of things have happened. And he boasts about, you know, the fact that we have a higher representation of Aboriginal people at universities, and, he dealt with, you know, the basic arguments of dominant societies over minority groups and Aboriginal populations, and they say, you know, we built new houses, we're increasing houses, we're opening up more education centres, but mind you, they've taken away our linguists, our right to speak our own language in the schools, and they don't teach anything about our culture in the schools. It's all white, about Captain Cook and his landing and the British,
mm-hmm.
and white settlement since then. They talk about the fact that, you know, we have a fairly high proportion of Aboriginal people now at universities, so what? That's a right, it's part of our evolutionary process to acquaint ourselves with the dominant society. And also he talked about, you know, the graduates and that a lot of things have happened. Sure, a lot of things have happened in 40 years, but unfortunately the basic fundamental principles that underpin our argument against this country and Britain is the fact that we've never ceded our sovereignty and the land was forcefully taken from us and we've never been restituted, never compensated or reparations paid. In regards to Australia, we now have the document where Queen Victoria, in 1875, stated in law through an order in council, and we found out an order in council in England means that when the Crown of England exercises her prerogative, it's like, you know, your president exercising his presidential powers,
mm-hmm.
vetoing laws in Parliament. She had, the monarch of England, had the power to exercise their prerogative. And in which case, when they issue an order in council, that becomes absolute law in the common law system of the whole of the Commonwealth, that part of the former British Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And what she did was that in law and in a now, and then they entrenched it within an act of the British Parliament in 1875, that the Queen, that Queen Victoria said that she, nor her heirs and successors, claim sovereignty or dominion over the Aboriginal people and their places and their rulers and chiefs. That's in law in England. Mm-hmm. We do not have to hypothesize about this. We do not have to argue that we never ceded our sovereignty, because it's recognized in the English Parliament and in their common law that England never claimed sovereignty or dominion over us. So our position now is one of a legal right. And so, unfortunately, we have over 300 languages still being spoken in this country,
mm-hmm.
Which is made up of something like 550 clan groups, subgroups, etc. And what we have now is that we have two sovereigns operating in one landmass. That is the British, who came, mm-hmm. and they established a parliament. And now we're forming a national unity government with Aboriginal people over the next 12 months, and we will then assert our sovereignty over the same soil. Now, someone will have to talk, and I dare say that it could well be, that we will ask for United Nations intervention and for them to mediate between the two parties, and then we might be able to come up with a republic in this country where Aborigines and whites share the governance in this country.
I see. So that's a new development then. It's an Indigenous unity government?
It will be an Indigenous unity government. Everyone's preferring the name Sovereign Union at this present, the Sovereign Union of Aboriginal Nations. But that will come out in the end. But in terms of the national unity movement right now, that's what we're doing, and we've got a plan in place for the next 12 months to put together a national unity government of Aboriginal Nations, and we will then call upon the Australian government to negotiate with us so that we have a shared arrangement, and we will become the United Party or United Australia, providing, of course, we can successfully negotiate a peace pact.
I see, a peace pact. And mm-hmm. so with the Labor Party and the National Liberal Party coalition, it's my understanding in the meantime that they're actually pushing to write Indigenous peoples into the Constitution of Australia?
They are, but again, it comes back to this choice of words that they have, and they say that, you know, Australia's first people. Now, to me, first people doesn't necessarily mean that we've been here from time immemorial. There is a suggestion in that language that, you know, we arrived here by boat or walked across land masses when it was all joined together. But, you know, we have big stories that go back a long, long way in this country. And our stories are that we belong to this land, we were born of this land, made of this land, our earth is the mother, and we are of that mother, and we've been here since time immemorial.
Mm-hmm. Also, in terms of the language of First People, not cutting it on the sovereignty front, you have described this push for constitutional development or inclusion as somewhat treasonous for the Indigenous leaders that are trying to go that route. Is that right?
I do. I call them treasonous. And treason to us is that they're committing treason against the sovereign nations of this country, the Aboriginal sovereign nations.
Right.
And under our law, just as it is treason in other countries of this world, that is punishable by death. Mm. And we have been calling for these people to be named and shamed, and if we can, you know, if we our people get hold of them, they will punish them, whether it's by death or not, but I know that they don't want them to be part of our community at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they want to be part of the white society, well, and so be it. They have that freedom to do so.
Mm-hmm.
But they will no longer be accepted or recognized in our group. And the constitutional reform that they're talking about in these referendum, we're saying if you're going to go down that pathway, well, then go down the whole log and separate from England and become a republic in our own right, because there's more foreign people now here in this country who've come here after the Second World War now than there are actually descendants of the Anglo-Saxon British people who came here during the first boatload of people, illegal boat people, in 1788. So we have a, you know, we have a very different set of circumstances, and a lot of those English and Baltic people and other foreign speaking people who are here make up a very big proportion of the population of Australia, and Britain is not part of their vocabulary.
Right. You're referring to the original English settlers as the first illegal boat people, right?
That's correct, yeah. They were not welcome here. They came here and they just planted themselves here.
Right.
And Australia's still having problems with boat people.
And also, if I can just go back to one other point, in terms of the indigenous leaders or self-proclaimed leaders, I'm not sure how you would frame them, who are interested in sort of going down this path of compromise, the threat then isn't just that they want to work with the white government, it's that their participation could be used as evidence of that acquiescence, right?
That's correct, and that's what we're saying. We're speaking loud and clear here, that those who choose to work with governments and be appointed with their committees and stay on the government committees, and who falsely and fraudulently misrepresent the fact that they speak for our people in the communities and in the grassroots, these people are deceivers, they are liars, they are, you know, misfits, as we call them. And unfortunately, we have to say this loud and clear, and they do not have a constituency of their own. They've been separated from their people for so long that they never go back and talk with the people. They have their in-house group of middle-class Aboriginal people in this country, mm-hmm. whom they associate with, who want to maintain their status as middle-class Aborigines. Well, and you know, we have nothing, we have no objections to that. Go for it, we say. But please don't say that you represent our people who are out there fighting for our rights and fighting for our sovereignty and land. And to have this, have it all fixed up and done properly, the way it should be. And we don't want them to sort of falsely represent and fraudulently represent the fact that they may be deceiving our people without their knowledge by acquiescing and participating in what the whites want.
Right. And that's regardless of whether we're talking about the Labor Party, National Liberal Party, or the neoconservatives, right?
Absolutely. If you're going to talk for us, you talk to us first, as people in the communities, in our country, in our languages. If you do not participate at our grassroots and community level and be with the people all the time, and if you want to lead the people and you want to be part of that and speak for them, then you really need to get out there on the grounds and be there with the people in their homes and listen to the troubles that exist there. Have a look at the prison rates. Have a look at the death rate. Have a look at the juvenile justice rates of incarceration. Have a look at the death rate, suicide amongst our youth in this country. You know, it's these people are lost people. They know they don't belong to white Australia. White Australia rejects them. White Australia teaches an education system based on whites, white supremacist thoughts in terms of, oh, you Aborigines never even invented the wheel, for example. Would have been a pretty rough ride with a kangaroo hopping along trying to pull a cart behind it. And, you know, how stupid were these people? We didn't have cows or goats or camels or anything like that in this country to pull a cart. Why would we want to invent a wheel, for heaven's sake?
Well, that's just another racist discourse that renders Indigenous peoples as primitive savages, right?
Absolutely. And you know, the thing is that these people are so far removed from nature and from the laws of nature that they do not have the capacity to even think about our group of people in the world, the tribal people of this world, had no need for wheels. We lived with nature.
That's great. No, it's a really important point to remember. And also that really is the core of Indigenous societies, is respecting the laws of nature.
Absolutely, and that's one of the things that I'll be doing in my doctorate law this year, is looking at the origins of the natural law and how we live within that and how we are part of it and how we are obliged to maintain it.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I'd like to keep in touch with you and to especially be kept abreast of this new political development in terms of the National Indigenous Unity Government. I hope that we can be in touch. I really appreciate you taking time to be on the show.
We have a lot to talk about, and hopefully As the Argentinian ambassador informed me, he said, if you can pull this off, you will change the face of the world for tribal peoples all over.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you so much for joining us on Indigenous Politics. Mahalo.
You're welcome.
And again, listeners, that was Michael Anderson, also known by his Indigenous name Gilar, here on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. I'm your host, Ke Haolani Kauanui. In this next part of the show, I will be airing a segment of a recent keynote delivered by Palestinian-American journalist Ali Abu Nima. This was presented on February 4th at the University of Pennsylvania 2012 National Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Conference. And before I air the segment, I want to tell you a bit more about Ali Abu Nima. Again, as I mentioned, he's a Palestinian-American journalist and co-founder of Electronic Intifada, which is a not-for-profit, independent online publication about the freedom struggle of the Palestinian people. Born in Washington, D.C., Abu Nima spent his early years in the United Kingdom and Belgium before returning to the United States to attend college. Abu Nima is a graduate of Princeton University and the University of Chicago. He lives in Chicago, Illinois, and is a fellow at the Palestine Center.
I've given you some examples of the brutal violence that Palestinians live under. Palestinians are told, you must be nonviolent. Why don't we hear that said to Israel? Could Israel build settlements without violence? Could it impose these conditions on people without violence and the threat of violence? Well, never mind. We heeded the call for nonviolence, and that's why we're here. The BDS movement is about restoring human rights for Palestinians through nonviolent citizen action in an inclusive movement that reflects the diversity of the people you see in this room. There is tremendous diversity here in this room, and that is reflected throughout the movement. Because, and we heard this from Omar Barghouti, and it was in his wonderful op-ed in the Daily Pennsylvanian, this movement is about building the broadest coalition for universal rights. And I want to talk about that now, because one of the charges that we hear, I mean, other than being compared to Hitler, is that this movement is about destruction. It's about something negative. It's about doing harm. So I want to take some time. And I think, Stand With Us, are you here tonight? Stand With Us, we're very proud to post an ad the other day with a picture of Omar Barghouti, making him look a little bit like Dracula with a red screen over him. It's part of the demonization strategy. Posing the question, does Israel have a right to exist as a Jewish state within any borders? That's a very good question, and we should try to answer it. But we should point the question back at our critics. What does it mean for Israel to be a Jewish state? Pray tell. Let's ask that question, and let's try to answer it. Are there any lawyers in the room? Alan Dershowitz here? We had one hand up here. Israel has a right to be a Jewish state. What's a right? There's no right without what? A remedy, that's it. There's no right without a remedy. Isn't that what they teach in law school? Come on. I haven't been to law school, so I'm counting on you. But the notion of a right is very straightforward. That if I have a right or you have a right, and it's violated, then you can pursue a remedy. But a remedy must be something that is legitimate. So if somebody steals from me, I could have a remedy by taking them to court, settling with them, getting compensation. There might be criminal penalties and so on. Those are remedies that we accept in our society when they're applied fairly and justly and equally. I don't have the right... we don't accept that as a remedy I have the right to go and break into his house and steal his stuff. We don't accept that that's a remedy. So the notion that Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish state, then if that right is violated, there must be a remedy. Correct? It follows logically. So how can Israel's right to be a Jewish state be violated? You can call it out, I don't mind. Well, one of the ways that, one of the things Israelis fret about all the time is babies. Babies just like the beautiful Rafif, who I had the pleasure of playing with for a few minutes earlier. Rafif, I see a beautiful child who has hopefully an incredible future in front of her. Israel sees a demographic threat. To Israel, Rafif is the mortal enemy. Too many babies of the wrong type threaten Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. So Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state is under mortal threat from babies. Too many of the wrong type of baby. So what's the remedy? What's the legitimate remedy for too many babies? Can anyone think of a legitimate remedy for too many babies? Well, one approach would be to stop the creation of wrong babies. And that, in fact, is exactly what Israel is trying to do with its so-called citizenship law, which prevents Palestinians from marrying other Arabs or other people from other Arab countries and Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And recently we told the story on the Electronic Intifada of Taysir Khatib from Akka and his wife Lena from Jenin. One of them is a citizen of Israel. The other isn't. Under Israeli law, they're not allowed to live together in Israel. And there are tens of thousands of families that are split this way. They actually do, this particular family, they do live in Akka, but because of this law, Lena has no rights, no health insurance, she can't drive. A Palestinian in historic Palestine with no rights whatsoever. And this law, when it was passed in 2003 originally, Ariel Sharon, who was prime minister at the time, explained that, you know, he said, let's not hide behind security, because that was the excuse, of course. There is a need for a Jewish state. And this law was designed to prevent Palestinians in Israel from marrying Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and later expanded to Arab countries and living together in the country and having wrong babies. That's what it's about. Now, you don't have to believe me, because this was affirmed recently, a few weeks ago, by Israel's High Court, which upheld the law against a challenge. And the ruling in the ruling, Justice Asher Grunis wrote, yes, there is a human right to live together as a family. But, quote, human rights are not a prescription for national suicide. In other words, allowing too many people of the wrong sort to live in the country and have babies is national suicide. What's so interesting is this language of demographic threat has a pedigree. My colleague Ben White discovered a few, we might be able to get these up on the screen later, went back into the archives and discovered some of the newspaper headlines and stories from the apartheid era in South Africa, where exactly the same language is used. Nation segregation policy needs white immigrants. Leaders in South Africa study population trends. Botha says economic sanctions preferable to national suicide. Prime Minister Daniel Malan warned in 1953 that equality, quote, equality must inevitably mean to white South Africans nothing less than national suicide. In 1948, the National Party, the party that instituted formal apartheid in South Africa, and Helena Cobben had some rich comments about this at the session earlier today, quote, either we must follow the course of equality, which must eventually mean national suicide for the white race, or we must take the course of separation. And as Ben White notes, this is now the refrain of Zionists, both extremist and liberal, and like in South Africa, it leaves the same bitter taste in the mouth. So, that's one example of what it means for Israel to be a Jewish state. Some of the other examples that that we've seen recently. Because of Israel's systematic discrimination against non-Jewish citizens since it was created, you know, you've had something like more than 800 new towns and settlements built for Jews in Israel since 1948. Does anyone know how many have been built for the Palestinian population?
No.
Zero, correct, zero. But of course, the Palestinian population, despite these restrictions, within Israel, Palestinian citizens of Israel, has grown tenfold from about 170,000 just after the Nakba, who were left behind in what became Israel, to about 1.5 million today. And because of the overcrowding, because of the land theft, because they're not allowed to build new towns and areas to live, they move to where the houses are. And where the houses are is where Jews are. So recently we've seen an incredible upsurge in decrees by Israeli rabbis. And now I don't want to misrepresent things. We're not talking about a couple of cuckoos out there. We're talking about hundreds of rabbis, including the chief rabbi of Safed, who have signed orders or religious decrees saying it is forbidden to rent to Arabs. And there have been cases reported in the Israeli press of Arab students being chased out of rented accommodation under threat. There was a story in Haaretz last year of a Holocaust survivor in Safed who rented an apartment that he owned to three students and received death threats. And what the rabbi letter says is that Jews who rent to Arabs should be boycotted. The only people who are talking about boycotting Jews are the hundreds of rabbis who signed this letter, whose salaries are paid by the State of Israel. That's what it means for Israel to be a Jewish state. It also means that that it's illegal for Palestinians to remember the Nakba, to commemorate it, that they suffer legal penalties if Palestinian citizens of Israel do so. Schools aren't allowed to teach about it. Teachers have been fired and harassed for teaching students about the real history of Israel. This reminds me, by the way, of what's happening here in this country in Tucson, Arizona, where recently books were banned. Books had to be taken out of the schools because of a new law that makes it illegal to teach Chicano and Mexican-American history. And just a few days ago, hundreds of high school students in Tucson walked out of their classrooms to protest this. These discriminatory laws. And it reminds me so much of what, if that offends you, then what's happening in Israel should offend you too, where teaching history has become illegal. And falsifying history is what great Harvard professors tell young students to do. I'll come back to that. What other remedies could Israel have if its right to be a Jewish state is violated? How about expelling Palestinians? Well, of course, that's how this vaunted Jewish majority was created in the first place. The so-called Jewish democracy came about through ethnic cleansing. And it has been maintained through preventing Palestinians from coming back to the country for one reason alone, that they're not Jews. That's the only reason 1.5 million people are corralled into Gaza. It's because they're not Jews. Do a thought experiment with me. If those 1.5 million people were in Gaza, the fences and walls would be torn down, and they would be encouraged to come back to live on the largely empty land where they came from. But because they're not Jews, they live in a giant enclosure called the Gaza Strip. That's what it means for Israel. Those are the remedies that Israel applies. Of course, now expulsions are what they call voluntary transfer are back in the fashion. This began in the 2000s, where it was once a taboo, and now you've had parties in the Israeli government that have run openly on a platform of so-called transfer, of getting rid of the Palestinian population in order to preserve Israel's so-called right to have a specific ethnic makeup. And a recent item caught my attention in Haaretz, which reported just a few days ago, that Israel had decided to deport several thousand refugees, asylum seekers, and migrants from South Sudan. And I'm quoting from the report. Spokesman Sabine Haddad says that since the southern Sudanese now have an independent state, they will no longer be given protected status in Israel. The country gained independence from Sudan in July. In addition, I won't say much about it, but we can come back to it in the Q&A. This fits into the whole racial and racist politics of Africans in Israel. But it's also a very ominous sign for Palestinians, because Israeli leaders have already hinted that they could use the same type of logic to justify expelling Palestinian citizens of Israel if a nominally independent Palestinian state, or Bantustan, is established in little bits of the West Bank and Gaza. In 2007, Tzipi Livni said, "The Palestinian state to be established will not be a solution just for the Palestinians who live in Judea and Samaria," what Israelis call the West Bank. "It is designed to provide a comprehensive national solution for those living in Judea and Samaria and the refugee camps, and even for Arab citizens of Israel." Tzipi Livni's words. So it's not hard to imagine the day after a Palestinian so-called state is created in the West Bank when Israel says, now you have your state, go there. This is a Jewish state. And Avigdor Lieberman has said it. Avigdor Lieberman, who I believe will be meeting with Hillary Clinton in coming days, has said, if there is a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, we will end up, they will end up with 1.5 states, and we will end up with 0.5 state. He's referring to Palestinians remaining in Israel and saying clearly that they should be expelled. So, there are many more examples of discriminatory laws and practices, and we heard about many of them throughout the conference. But the question then is, do you accept that these are legitimate remedies? Do you accept that these are legitimate remedies if Israel's so-called right to be a Jewish state is violated by babies like Rafif?
No.
You have to answer that question, and our critics have to answer that question. And if you answer yes, then you have to accept the awful moral consequences of that decision, that you are supporting some of the most vile ways of categorizing and segregating and separating human beings. And if you answer no, then join us in seeking a future in which everybody's rights are respected. Let's remind ourselves of the three basic demands of the Palestinian civil society call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Of course, overall, that Israel should obey international law and respect the human rights of the Palestinian people, but in three specific ways. Ending the military occupation of all Arab lands occupied in 1967, ending all forms of discrimination and recognizing equality for Palestinians in Israel, and respecting and promoting the rights of Palestinian refugees, including the right of return. None of these goals contradict any legitimate human rights of any Israelis. How does ending military occupation threaten the rights of Israelis? How does stopping taking land, like the land of the people of Nabi Saleh or of Yusuf Ikhlel and his family, threaten Israelis? How does stopping a crime threaten Israelis? How does equal rights for Palestinian citizens of Israel threaten Israelis? How does it prevent Israelis from exercising all of their human rights, from exercising promoting their culture and religion? How does equal rights for Palestinians threaten that? And refugees, how does it threaten Israeli human rights for Palestinians to be allowed to return to live in the country of their birth and of their parents' and grandparents' birth on land that is largely empty? Because a little known fact, the vast majority of the land from which Palestinian refugees were expelled is empty today. How does that threaten any legitimate Israeli human rights? I'll tell you what it does threaten. It threatens Israeli privileges. It threatens illegitimate privileges based on ethnicity or, in this case, religion. And no, Israelis, as human beings, have all the same human rights as everyone else, but they don't have a right to superiority. And that is what exists today.
And again, listeners, that was a segment of a keynote address by Ali Abu Nima, which was presented on February 4th at the University of Pennsylvania 2012 National Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Conference. You've been listening to Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond with your host, Kehaulani Kawanui. Thank you for tuning in. Mahalo.